welcome to Catch a Mac Science. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. Once a month on Saturday from 11 a.m. to noon, Catch a Mac Science will provide a platform for discussion, inquiry, and peer review of local science. The topic this month on Catch a Mac Science is building science. And we have one guest. That guest is Scott Waterman, the owner of Spirited Energy Ventures here in Homer. Waterman recently retired as the Energy Programs Manager for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and he has nearly 30 years' experience in clean energy and efficiency. He helped initiate and implement the Home Energy Rebate Program and the Alaska Retrofit Information System. He also managed Alaska's home energy rating system. Scott's business, Spirited Energy Ventures, operates with the goal of lowering the cost of solar energy in Alaska. Waterman is teaching a series of classes through the Homer Folk School. Those classes run on Wednesday nights from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Kachemak Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College. Upcoming topics for his classes include heating systems and fuel types, indoor air quality, and electric use, as well as home and small business renewables. You can register by going to homerfolkschool.org. On the day of this interview, the topic of Scott's class was the topic of this show, Building Science. He dropped into the studios of KBBI and sat down to share his expertise.
Issues of fossil fuels and renewables and clean energy and climate change, and so I mean it could mushroom out pretty quickly.
Well, let's start with you.
All right.
Who are you? You're Scott Waterman.
I'm Scott Waterman. I recently retired from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation as the Energy Programs Manager. I spent 25 years there. I got into it probably in the late 1970s. There was a nuclear power plant being built in Seabrook, New Hampshire. And at the time, I didn't think that nuclear power was the right way to go, because we didn't then, and we still don't, know what to do with the waste products. And anything that has half-lives of thousands or even millions of years is not good for people, animals, or the environment. So I went to Seabrook, New Hampshire, and I happened to run into a gentleman by the name of Pete Seeger there.
And heard of him?
I got a chance to talk with him for about 20 minutes, and he said it's really easy to say no to something, but if you want to make a change in the world, you have to have a vision, and you have to have a yes that you can pursue, and you have to have an idea that you want to make into reality. And I was probably 18 years old at the time, and it made a huge impression on me. So while I was there protesting the construction of this nuclear power plant, which ultimately got built and went into production anyway, albeit with huge cost overruns, it was always on the back of my mind that I wanted to do something different. And I went into the Navy, and I traveled around a bit, and I ended up here in Alaska in the early 1980s. And one of my very first jobs I had was working for a contractor building passive solar houses. Very energy efficient, or what we knew to be a very efficient house at the time, but incorporating passive solar, south-facing windows. We loaded one crawl space up with rocks and blew warm air down during the day, and were in theory able to bring that heat back up into the house at night. Unfortunately, we didn't understand the building science, and ultimately those rocks got cold, and when we blew warm, moist air onto them, we created a whole lot of condensation and a lot of water, and that didn't work because we didn't understand the building science.
What is the building science here?
What is building science? What is building science? Building science is how heat, air, and moisture interact with each other in a building. And in its simplest terms, how the flows of heat, air, and moisture move in a building, they have some fairly strong interactions. So take air first. Air is fairly ubiquitous in a building. We can't stop it from coming in. We can't stop it from leaving a building, nor do we really want to. If we were to create an airtight space, soon we would use up all the oxygen, we'd have a plethora of carbon dioxide, high moisture levels, and people could not survive. And we'd have also high pollutant levels. So we need a certain amount of air movement through a building. Our motto in the building science industry is to build it tight and then ventilate right. We have to have good ventilation in a tight building. Now, we do want to control air movement through the walls, the floor, and the ceiling as much as possible, and limit that so that we can manage the amount of air that is coming in or leaving the building at a level that we choose, not just something that happens. So understanding how air moves in a building is a key. One of the things that we learn with air movement is that warm air, of course, rises. It's more buoyant and less dense than cold air. On a day where it's zero outside and 70 degrees inside the building, we have this almost a balloon effect where we have a lot of warm air pushing against the top of the building. Any little crevice, crack, penetration of any sort will allow air to leave the building with that. That air can also transfer moisture at a fairly significant rate. If we have a 50% relative humidity inside the building, that air leaving the building is carrying 50% relative humidity. And if it's going from 70 degrees, the general rule of thumb is that for every 20 degree drop in temperature, you double the relative humidity. So it only takes a 20 degree drop in temperature for 50% relative humidity to become saturated air, and will condense, and it's going to likely condense in the first cold available spot, often the insulation level. So in a situation like we had just a couple of weeks ago, we can see a lot of warm, moist air leaving and bringing a lot of moisture air with it into the attic and then soaking the insulation. And I bet if people were to go up into their attics right now, you'd find a lot of wet insulation because it's warmed up. That condensation went up there, it condensed and it froze. So it went through two phase changes from a vapor to water itself and then to ice. And now back to water again, and wet insulation does not resist heat anywhere near as well as dry insulation. In a nutshell, building science is just understanding all the different heat, air, and moisture flows in a building, and that's just touching the surface.
You are doing a series at Kachemak Bay Campus to give people an overview of what you are going to be talking about in the coming weeks. Okay.
Energy efficiency and clean energy in general. I'll be talking February 13th on indoor air quality and the need for good ventilation. How do we limit pollutants and how do we control the amount of air we need to push through a building to keep the occupants healthy and safe without using an excess amount of energy? to do so. So we'll be talking about carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, hazards of cleaners, the types of cleaners, the things that we bring into our homes that have an excess of pollutants that off-gas, furniture, carpeting. We'll be talking about mold. We'll be talking about combustion hazards from heating appliances, fireplaces, wood stoves, furnaces, water heaters, boilers, etc. So we'll be talking a lot about indoor air quality. On February 20th, we'll be talking about electric use in general and what we can do to control how much electric use and how we can both conserve by turning things off and make things more efficient, which is getting the same result but using less energy. LED lighting is a great example.
I was just about to ask for an example of that.
Yeah, so LED lighting has come a tremendously long way in a very short time. In 2012, I was not recommending LED lighting at all.
Why not? Because of
because the quality of light was poor. The amount of light was limited, and we really didn't have much control over it. The color rendering was bad. It was a harsh blue light that we really didn't. Most people really didn't care for. And today, in 6 short years, we've seen a tremendous increase in lighting.
I have to ask. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead.
But as you were saying, the harsh blue for the old LED, is that what's blinding me in people's headlights?
The color makes a huge difference, yes. It's also, so lighting is made up of several things. There's, one of it is the volume of light, the brightness, and that's measured in lumens. Older quartz halogen headlights, for example, we would see maybe 650 lumens in one headlight on high beam. Today, we're seeing upwards of 6,000 to 8,000 lumens. The volume of light that's coming out of these headlights is great. Much greater, you know, by a magnitude of order, but also the color. The older quartz halogen lights were a very warm light, and that is measured on the Kelvin scale, and those were usually in the 2700 degrees Kelvin for the color, that's called the color temperature. The blue lights that you're seeing in a lot of new automobile headlights are probably upwards of 6,000 to 8,000 degrees Kelvin. So that's a very blue light. It's approaching sunlight, which is 10,000 degrees Kelvin. And sunlight appears yellow, but if you were to actually isolate the light waves in it, it's a very, what we call white light. It's almost a pure white light. But it would appear blue, and that's often what causes the colors of glaciers to look as they do, the blue that we see in the glacier. So we'll be talking a lot about how we can improve our lighting using less energy. We'll be talking about appliances and where you can make a difference with your appliances, your dishwasher, your washing machine, refrigeration, and those types of things. And then the next week we'll be talking, this is on February 27th, we'll be talking about home and small business renewables and how to manage your energy in your home and your business with both energy efficiency practices and renewables, and what renewables make sense here in Homer today. And then the last two sessions are going to be specifically on solar electric, photovoltaics, and solar thermal, which is heat that we can get from solar panels. And I'll be using my house as a case study on that.
House here in Homer?
Yes, on Diamond Ridge. So we'll be talking about how people can incorporate solar electric and solar thermal into their homes.
This is a class at Ketchum at Bay Campus. Do you have to register?
Yes, it is actually through the Homer Folk School. The Homer Folk School is a new nonprofit folk school here in Homer that is bringing local teachers in to teach on a wide variety of subjects from energy to mental health to gardening to permaculture to automotive mechanics to whatever you can think of.
Whatever folks want to learn.
Whatever folks want to learn, they can learn at the folk school. So it's a great opportunity for local expertise to be shared.
There is an admission.
Classes are $25 each. You can register through homerfolkschool.org.
Okay. I would like to hear a little bit about your house on Diamond Ridge. What was it when you started? How was it getting its heat and its light and such when you started? And what was the process a little bit?
All right. My wife bought the property in 2005. And there was a straw bale house on it that had been built in 1996. Straw bale is interesting.
I know of one in town.
Yeah. It's interesting, but it's not necessarily something I would recommend for this area. The climate, we have a lot of wind-driven rain. We have a lot of internal moisture. And there is the potential for that straw to get wet. It's also very expensive to import here.
Well, that was my question. The expense, and then isn't there a chance that it will mold?
There is a chance. So when she bought it, it was before we had gotten together, but we were friends, and she asked me if I would recommend anyone to take a look at it before she bought it. She wanted to know whether there was going to be a problem with it. And she had a gentleman from the head of the bay come out, and he brought an infrared scanner, and he looked at it with the infrared, and he said there's a couple of areas that look like they could be wet. I can't tell unless I drill it. The previous owners didn't want to have it drilled and probed for moisture because they really didn't want to know. So they said, no, you can't drill it. She walked away from the deal, and a year later, they called her and said, would you be interested if we renegotiate the price? They negotiated the price down quite a bit. She bought it. She called the guy back. He came out. He drilled and probed the walls. Oh, it's fine. No problem. So from there, her utility bills were still very high. She was paying in the wintertime between $400 and $500 a month for propane. And it was marginally comfortable. You couldn't always get the house really warm throughout. So she asked me what could be done. And by this time we had gotten together, and so she at first asked if I would take it off the grid, and I said, you know, your heating costs are the vast majority of your energy bills. Let's go after that first. So we added additional insulation to the roof. We insulated the crawl space. We did a bunch of air sealing, and we dropped the monthly propane bill from approximately $450 a month to about $165 a month.
That's significant.
Significant. So that was stage one. The next phase was we were actually looking to make it a clean energy building. We found that we were hosting groups for workshops and different things up there, and we needed more space. We only had one bathroom. We had an outhouse, but we often had to import porta potties, you know, we had workshops. So we decided that we would build a second building, not really an addition to the house, but a second building. And we made a connector so that all the utilities could be shared, the electric and the water and sewer and all that sort of thing, septic. Two buildings are close, but they're not actually there. It is actually two separate buildings. With that, we put in a mechanical room, 7,000 gallon water storage under the floor in the foundation, and we put 20 solar thermal panels on the roof. The solar thermal heats the building from about early February through the end of October. So we miss out on November, December, January. There's just not enough sun to keep it going. But usually by about the second week in February, we can pretty much not have to run the boiler anymore until the end of October.
And what year was this when you put those on?
2010.
And how have solar panels changed?
This is solar thermal. So there's a fluid that goes through the panels, is pumped through the panels, and heated by the sun, and then returned to the tank. The solar thermal has been around for a long time, and it really hasn't changed that much. That's the basic premise of that. And it does provide us with most of our heat and almost all of our domestic water for 9 months out of the year. The remaining 3 months, we have a wood-fired boiler. And if we run that boiler for about 8 to 10 hours in a day, that's enough heat to generally take care of us for about 5 to 7 days, depending on what the outdoor temperature.
Your house must be tight as boat. Did a boat builder build your house?
No.
It's tightest heat-sealed houses I ever lived in were built by boat builders.
Sure. They understand. Yeah. So with that, we were successful in heating the house 9 months out of the year, and the remaining 3 months we use wood. We have a wood cook stove that is our primary cooking source.
So you have an old school stove with a firebox in it?
Yes.
And is it a new one? Is it an antique?
It's a new one. It's probably about 25 years old now. It was new in 1996 when the house was built. So not quite 25, but coming up on it. It's a nice Stanley wood stove. And when we fire it up for breakfast in the morning, it's enough to, kind of add that little bit of extra heat that keeps the house warm all day. And it only burns for maybe an hour, but provides just enough comfort heat that it makes things very pleasant for the rest of the day.
Do you also use the other kind of solar panels? The
photovoltaics create electricity from sunlight. And we put those on in May of 2018. So we don't have quite a full year's worth of data yet on those, but we've been doing quite well. A couple of days earlier in January, we were back up over 25 kilowatts per day. We have about 7.5 kilowatt array. It's what we call a solar fence along our driveway. We just drove piles at about a 70 degree angle and put rails on those, and generally the snow doesn't stick to them, although it was this morning.
Oh yeah, it's very wet and sticky out there now.
Yeah, but I suspect it'll slide off pretty quickly, and a little bit of the panels do heat up, and so as soon as there's a little bit of exposure to them, they warm enough and the snow just slides off. So, but they'll probably generate somewhere on the order of 80% of our electric use throughout the year. We do obviously use, the solar is not well suited for our winter time where it's most dark, when our lights are on most hours of the day. And so our electric bills do go up in the winter time, November, December, January. By the time the sun returns in early February, we begin to cut back on our usage again. So we overproduce in the summertime and don't produce quite enough in the winter. But even there, I'm estimating that we'll get at least 80% of our electric covered from the solar on a year-round basis.
When you say you overproduce, is it possible for you to share that energy?
We could, although right now what we do is we put it back on the grid, and Homer Electric buys it back from us at their avoided cost rate, which is about 8 cents per kilowatt.
Has it become law that the local energy co-ops have to buy it back from you?
That's called the net metering law. And so the Homer Electric Association or any electric company in Alaska does have to buy power back from you if you're overproducing. They can do what's called net metering on a 30-day basis, which means if I produce 1,000 kilowatts in September and I produce 500 kilowatts in October and my usage is 500 kilowatts a month, I can go into November and not have to pay for any electric that I'm using from the grid. But then by December, I'm going to have to pay for that. And if I'm overproducing what I use the next month, then Homer will buy it back from me at the 8 cents a kilowatt, or what they call the avoided cost rate. And that will vary over the course of the year.
Can you overproduce enough to offset how much you have to use in the wintertime?
Because it's only a 30-day net, no. Because right now, I just got my January bill, and I used 880 kilowatts. I only produced maybe 250, so I had to buy the difference. So a lot of the work that I do is things that are behind the scenes: insulation in the attic, air sealing around your venting and plumbing pipes, tune-ups on your heating systems, all of those types of things are not anywhere near as interesting as a solar panel out in the yard or up on the roof. But energy efficiency is the foundation of renewable energy, and you cannot go into a renewable energy system without doing the efficiency first. Because the cheapest power that you can produce is that which you don't have to use. If you can produce what Amory Lovins affectionately calls negawatts, by reducing your electric use before you go in and put solar or wind or something to produce power, then you're going to be a lot further ahead. And you can reduce the size of the system you need, lower the cost, and make it a whole lot more affordable. And you're going to make your home healthier, safer, more comfortable, more durable, and of course more affordable. So the efficiency is a key part of any clean or renewable energy system. And within the United States, if we were as efficient as Japan or Norway or Germany, we would cut our electric use or our energy use in half right off the bat.
And what are the differences?
Americans are incredibly wasteful when it comes to how they use energy.
Our culture celebrates waste and excess.
Yeah. It does, to a certain extent. Now, when we look at the cost, here in Homer, we've seen the cost for our electric rate per kilowatt jump from about 13 cents per kilowatt in 2012 to almost 23 cents a kilowatt in 2019. I'm not doing the percentages in my head, but that's a big jump. Where are they going to go in the future? The cost for efficiency, when you figure out what you have to put in the way of additional insulation or changes to your heating system or air sealing or whatever it is, usually comes out on the order of about 3 to 4 cents a kilowatt. So rather than paying 23 cents a kilowatt, you can invest, which the amount of about 4 cents a kilowatt is going to reduce your energy use considerably. We have, in some cases, on this end of the peninsula, we have very cheap natural gas.
Are you able to access that?
I cannot access natural gas where I live. We don't have that opportunity. So the people that are stuck on oil have a whole lot more cost for the same amount of energy used just because of their fuel type. The natural gas system is not ever going to hit a lot of these places because the density is so low that NSTAR is just not going to be interested in running a line down that way. We just are not going to be able to see that in many places. So efficiency is ever more important there, because we've seen heating fuel prices wander between maybe $2.50 a gallon and $5 a gallon over the last 6 years. And they're down right now, but what's going to happen in the future? We don't know. So volatility is a huge issue, and it's even more so in a business. So efficiency in a business is something that any business owner should be concerned with. Any money that you invest and save in your energy bills goes straight to your bottom line. That's money in your pocket at the end of the day. So there's no reason not to do it. And in many of the businesses and public buildings that I've looked at, we can see oftentimes a 10 to 15% savings without any investment whatsoever. This is just by making sure that the operating system for the building is aligned with when there's people in the building. And for an example, there was a school in the Matsu Valley that we looked at, and we found that between midnight and 6 a.m., when there was no one in the building, things were not getting shut off at the rate that they should have been. There's an automation system on that building, but it had just not been programmed. And when we were able to see what was going on with the automation system, they spent about an hour and a half with a technician, and they made changes that resulted in $100,000 a year in savings for an hour and a half of the technician's time. $100,000 per year. And many businesses, while they may not have electric bills or energy bills that are that high, that type of savings can come along as well. And you know, we see up to 20% savings sometimes just by making changes to how the building is operated. Invest a little bit in some controls, make those operations a little more automated, and you can see even more savings. Invest in additional insulation, better heating systems, better lighting, and you can often see up to 30 to 40% savings. So look at your overall energy bills and say, 15% is going to save me this much, 30% this much, and you'll see, wow, there's a lot of money there. And this is year in, year out, every year. And so take a look at it for over the next 10 years and see what that savings comes up to, and you'll wonder why you didn't do it 10 years ago.
I'd like to know about the sources that you learned from and the contemporary sources that you trust. You mentioned Amory Lovins.
Mm-hmm. Amory Lovins is with the Rocky Mountain Institute in Snowmass, Colorado. He's mostly doing high-end consulting now. He helped Walmart, for example, develop a fleet of energy-efficient trucks. He's done a lot of work for the Pentagon. They've got a lot of concerns about climate change. And a lot of the things that he has done over the years have helped the Pentagon save an estimated $3 billion a year in military energy expenditures. And when you look at the military and how things work, a gallon of diesel fuel on the battlefield can cost upwards of $500 a gallon. So when you think about all the transportation and security that's needed to get it there, energy efficiency is incredibly important to them. Yeah, I learned through a variety of different sources.
Any that you would recommend to people?
Well, I'm not sure that they're available today. What I do have, what is available today is Places like the Alaska Craftsman Home Program, the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has a whole bunch of consumer classes that are offered on a regular basis. So any of those can be offered. You can take any of those. And there's a number of good builders here in Homer that also understand energy efficiency and are building really high-end houses here, highly efficient houses, and they're doing a really good job. There's probably more good builders in the Homer area than just about any other part of the state, except maybe Fairbanks.
And do you do assess? You have a company. Do you do assessments for
people? I do assessments. I can do an energy audit, residential or commercial. I'm not an energy rater. I usually would do a walkthrough audit and just look and give you a report back on what I see.
When you say you're not an energy rater?
There are energy raters in Homer, and they're authorized through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. They're able to do an energy rating that allows you to access some of the energy efficiency programs that AHSC offers. They're able to do that. I can usually help diagnose troubles. Find out where the energy use is going. I did one a month or so ago, and it turned out there was children in the house that had some respiratory problems, and so they had air cleaners, air filters, and they had two of them running. And when we totaled what the energy use on those two units was, it was significant. They also had a 250-watt light bulb to keep the chickens warm, and they had a couple of portable electric heaters in the house. And it didn't seem like they had that much energy use, but when we really started looking at it, we found it. And they were up using about 1,900 kilowatts a month, and the average is probably about 700.
You were talking about, at your house, collecting your data for the new solar cells.
Yep.
So if someone is getting ready for an assessment or an energy audit, they should be collecting their data, shouldn't they? What should they be, what should I be collecting?
That is a little bit more challenging. Now, the first thing the first line of data is that you can go on the Homer Electric site and pull down your data. You can just log in and you can see what your use has been for the last year. So that's the first place you can go. If you're an NSTAR customer, you can do the same with them. If you're on oil, you'll want to collect your records, and you can maybe call your oil supplier and see if they have records going back at least a year, preferably two. And that's a good place to start, because you want to see what your energy use is throughout the year and not just what it was last month. We never know, because of climate, you know, how this January compares to last January, and your January use is definitely going to be different than your July use. We want to see how the energy is used throughout the year, and we do like to see if there are any changes from this January to last January that were not based on weather changes. So is there another person living in the house, or has a teenager gone off to college? That type of thing will dramatically change what's going on. But if there's no change in the household status and we see energy use way up, we want to find out why.
Well, I've made significant difference just getting a new instead of an ancient clothes dryer in my house.
There you go.
That thing sucked energy.
Yep.
You have twice now mentioned climate change. Are there trends or new energy models that are happening because of climate change, or are you making plans and projections based on 10 years worth of data?
Interestingly enough, since the late 1990s, energy efficiency programs have nationwide in the United States have kept CO2 emissions relatively flat, even though there's been a tremendous increase in the GDP and the economic growth within the United States. So the efficiency improvements have held emissions to 1990 levels until this last year. And we saw a fairly significant spike in emissions from the U.S. in 2018. And that is in part from some of the national relaxation of regulations that this administration is putting in. And
it's that quick.
It was that quick. Yes, indeed. And it's a mindset and it's a culture, I think. If the administration is leading the path to increased energy use and increased emissions, there's a mindset there. And as you pointed out earlier, there's a culture of waste within the United States instead of a culture of efficiency like there is in Japan and a lot of the countries in Europe. The level of comfort that people can achieve, if you're not interested in your energy use, how about comfort? How about health? These are things that improve when we make our buildings more efficient. So there's really a lot of reasons, and durability as well. If we have a lot of excessive moisture leaking throughout the building in an uncontrolled manner, we can see mold and rot and degradation to parts of the building that will need to be replaced sooner.
Oh yeah, my house is going to have to be stripped of the studs.
Yeah.
that's what's going to happen.
So by making the homes more efficient, we can make them last longer. And they're more comfortable, they're healthier, they're safer, and more affordable. On the subject of climate change, the emissions that are produced in the United States are greater than those anywhere else in the world. United States produces about 25% of all climate emissions around the world. We only have about 5% of the world's population. So we're inordinately overproducing in emissions. As I said earlier, if we could be as efficient as some of the Northern European countries or Japan, we could cut our energy use in half. And I think that's a laudable goal, but that's part of a cultural shift that needs to be led in many different areas. And it isn't a political issue, it's an economic one. And it's also one that we need to look at for our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren. Because what kind of world are we gonna leave for Willie Nelson and Keith Richards? I think there's a lot that can be done, and it's economic, it's health, it's environmental, it's comfort. All of these things can be improved. Our quality of life will go up. Our investments in efficiency will pay off for decades to come, because the average life of a building in the United States is at least 100 years. 80% of all the buildings that will exist in 2050 are already built today. And we can make these buildings a whole lot more affordable. We can make these buildings a whole lot more comfortable. And we can make these buildings use a whole lot less energy, have a better quality of life. And it's not that difficult.
Often I tell people when I'm outside, when I'm visiting my family in Kentucky, and oh, Alaska, absolutely beautiful. I mean, yes, absolutely beautiful. It is not the place to be if your greatest love is fine architecture.
Yeah.
However, the low ceilings, the things that Alaskans have always done, what's the style for Alaskan houses? I mean, the reason why our ceilings are so low often is energy efficiency, because we need all that heat.
Yep, we don't need to heat a lot of high space. And again, warm air will rise, and you'll have a lot of warm air up 10, 11 feet up if you have high ceilings, and that's not doing anybody any good.
And when someone comes to you and says, I need to make my house more efficient, what are some of the first things that you ask them?
Tell them? The things that I go after first are air leakage. Get a blower door test.
What is it?
It's a blower door is just a fan that they put in the doorway. It's got a cover, a nylon cover around a frame that fits in the doorway, and a fan that's about maybe 2 feet in diameter. A fairly good size fan they will turn that fan on and blow air out of the house until you reach a certain pressure. Air is 1 cubic foot of air leaving the house will bring in another cubic foot of air from somewhere. And when you hit a certain pressure, we can measure the airflow through the fan at that pressure and determine how leaky the house is and where those leaks are coming from. Are they coming from the crawl space? Are they coming from the attic? Are they coming around the windows? And it may be all of the above, but where are the big leaks coming from? And let's get after those first. So air leakage and air control is the first thing we want to go after. And with that, we have to put ventilation in. The next thing we want to look at is the heating system. Is the heating system, where is it at on the efficiency scale? Most heating systems, natural gas or oil, should be better than 80% efficient. The best ones are up around 95 to 96% efficient.
The test that you were talking about, Homer Electric Association will do those, come to your home and
no,
do that?
No, for that you would need to hire one of the energy raters.
You have to hire someone for that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then the heating system, you know, make sure it's cleaned and tuned on an annual basis. Maintenance is incredibly important, just like your car needs a tune-up periodically. Your heating system does as well.
Something furnace, as filters, simple as, keeping your filters clean.
Keeping your filters clean, making sure that the pressures are right in boilers and all of these different things, that the temperatures are set to where they should be, not too high, not too low. Your water heater, people used to set them to 140 degrees. They really only need to be set to about 120 degrees. And dishwashers have heaters in them now that can up the temperature to 140 within the dishwasher. And so we no longer need to do that. Most of the taps are limited by mixing valves at 130 degrees anyway. So there's no point to heat your water any more than 120 degrees. That can save a lot of money right off the top. If it's an electric water heater, put a blanket on it. If it's a gas water heater, you can put a blanket on, but you need to make sure that you don't cover any of the air inlets or keep it away from the flames and that type of stuff. So
very
it's a little
important.
Bit more complicated. The next level after that is low flow shower heads and taps. We really don't need more than, I've got a really nice shower head that is only 2 gallons a minute. And a lot of the older shower heads were 4 or 5 gallons per minute. So if you can cut that in half, you can have a very comfortable shower, use a lot less water and a lot less energy. After that, we look at the insulation levels. Where can
it's
we
not
add
rocket insulation
buildings that makes sense? Usually we can get some in the attic. Oftentimes we can get it in the crawl space. And we can make a difference with that. Warm your floors, hold the heat in, and it's going to make a difference. And then finally, the last thing we look at is windows and doors.
And is there anything in particular that you would like to end this discussion with?
Energy is a part of every aspect of our lives. It is the driver for our economic engine. How we use energy in our world is incredibly important, and the choices that we're making today will affect the comfort and health of the planet for generations to come. So it is an important thing for everyone to be thinking about, and there is a lot that anyone can do in their home, in their business, in their community, in their state. At any level, we can do better. It's not rocket science, it's building science.
That is Scott Waterman from Spirited Energy Ventures here in Homer. There is still time to sign up for his classes at Kachemak Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College. They run on Wednesday nights from 6 to 7:30 p.m. You can register through the Homer Folk School at homerfolkschool.org. Next month on Kachemak Science, we will dedicate the whole hour to celebrating the 20th birthday of the Kachemak Bay National Estuary and Research Reserve. This show is produced at the studios of KBBI Public Radio in Homer, Alaska. Our theme music is by the Supreme Beings of Leisure, mixed with whale sounds from Deep Voices recordings of humpback blue and right whales, produced by Roger Payne. You can listen to a recording of this show by going to kbbi.org and dropping down from the programming menu to click on Kachemak Science. Thanks for listening. Kachemak Science will be back in 4 weeks with more discussions, presentations, and reviews in the lab, in the classroom, and in the field. We share the data from local science by local scientists.